Hello, this is Terrence McNally. Impeachment number two is over. Trump is still off Twitter. Vaccines are on the rise, and the Biden administration is committed to relief for American families. So let's take a breath and listen to my remarkable 2002 conversation with National Geographic explorer in residence, Wade Davis, about his wild path to the corners of the earth from the Amazon to the Arctic, his experiences with psychotropic plants, the pluses and minuses of Western progress, and the threats to indigenous peoples is told in his book, The Light at the Edge of the World, A Journey Through the Realm of Vanishing Cultures. You know how kids, well, let's say boys, all want to grow up to be rock stars or professional athletes or president or maybe just drive a really big truck? Well, that's because they probably don't know what the coolest job in the world is. Today's guest has it. Wade Davis is an explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, which he tells me means they pay for him to explore the world. But to get that job, he did have to do some stuff. He had to spend 25 years studying the plants, psychotropic drugs, and ceremonial rituals of indigenous cultures. And not only that, one of his first anthropology books was made into a Hollywood movie. I mean, this guy's life is not bad. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives and the work and the ideas of individuals that I suspect hold pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new and innovative and provocative models in business, environment, health, science, politics, and media. And it's all based on the fact that I think we can do better. And I want to find out how. Wade Davis is an anthropologist, lecturer, photographer, and environmental activist who's done extensive fieldwork throughout the world. He graduated from Harvard and also got his PhD there. He's the best-selling author of, among other works, The Serpent and the Rainbow, that's the one that was made into a movie, One River, and the new Light at the Edge of the World, A Journey Through the Realm of Vanishing Cultures. He's a member of the Explorers Club and the Royal Geographical Society, which just sounds so around the world in 80 days to me, as well as executive director of the Endangered Peoples Project, and he serves on the boards of several other nonprofits. He was also the host and co-writer of Earth Guide, a 13-part television series on the environment, which aired on the Discovery Channel and has had a hand in several other award-winning television projects. Welcome, Wade Davis, to KPFK and Free Forum.
Hi, Terry.
Okay, now my first question, Wade, as it is to all my guests, is about your own personal path to the work that you do today. You can go back as far as you want and take a while, you know, childhood dreams, mentors, models, turning points. And in your case, I noticed that the new book, Light at the Edge of the World, is not about just your most recent travel or, you know, a recent event. It's really kind of a culmination of a worldview you've picked up in years of work. So I'd be really interested in you weaving that whole journey, how you got started into this exploring life and how one thing may have led to another.
Well, you know, Terry, I think one of the kind of misconceptions we have in education and in the teaching of our children in particular is this idea that that life is linear, you know, that you go from A to B to C to D, and if you don't go through E and F, you'll never get to G and H. And it's completely untrue. I mean, all of us know that a life is actually formed by those serendipitous moments of opportunity where suddenly out of the blue comes a set of choices, and how you respond to those choices really determines the avenue of your life. And in my case, that's really the key to education. What we should be doing is teaching our young people to have the character so that when those moments come along, they can listen to their heart. They will know where, as Joseph Campbell said, of course, to follow their bliss. And if they do so, when they get to be our venerable age of 50 or whatever the heck we are, you look backwards and you see that every choice you made was by definition the right one, and the pattern of your life is whole, complete. And I think that's the key to a life of sanity. Now, in my life, I've been totally driven by those moments of serendipity. You know, I first went to Harvard, for example. I was from a relatively modest middle-class family in British Columbia in the west coast of Canada, and I used to fight forest fires in the summer as a way of making a few bucks. And this was during the height of the Vietnam War, when draft dodgers by the score were flooding into British Columbia, and the only work they could get was in the fire camps because no one asked any questions. And we were these obsequious, obedient Canadian lads, and they were absolutely irreverent, which gave them a charisma hot to the touch. And one of them, by complete chance, had a copy of the Life magazine that had the 1969 Harvard student strike on the cover, of which you were a major figure.
Well, not major, but I was in there. And in fact, I think one of my pictures might have been in that magazine.
Well, in a kind of raw, atavistic way, I thought, well, this must be the place you go to college to become like these guys. And of course, I applied to the university. I was fortunate to get in, and I discovered it wasn't quite the world that I had imagined, but it was something indeed more wondrous. But again, those serendipitous moments come along. I remember after being at the university for a couple of years studying anthropology, my roommate and I were, he was also an anthropologist, a rough cut kid from Spokane, Washington, and we found ourselves in a little cafe in Harvard Square. And there was a National Geographic map of the world right in front of us, about a foot away from our eyes. And David, my roommate, suddenly looked at this map, looked at me, looked back to the map, looked at me, looked to the map, and I saw his arm lift and he pointed to the Arctic. And then he looked at me. And suddenly, I watched my left arm lift and my finger landed in the Amazon. Now, if it happened to hit Italy, I might have been a Renaissance scholar today. But having decided to go to the Amazon, there was only one man to see, the legendary plant explorer, Richard Evans Schultes, who was the director of the Botanical Museum. And in a time of few heroes in the early 1970s, there was this one remarkable mentor who loomed large in the Harvard campus, a kindly professor who shot blowguns in class and kept outside his door a bucket of peyote buttons available as an optional laboratory experiment for his students. He was a curious man. He was a great legend. Mountains were named for him in South America, as were national parks. And Prince Philip had called him the father of ethnobotany. He was the legendary plant explorer who in 1941 had taken a semester's leave of absence from the university and disappeared in the forests of the northwest Amazon, where he remained for 13 years, traveling down unknown rivers, living amongst unknown peoples, all the time enchanted by the mysteries of the tropical rainforest. And of course, it was Schultes who sparked the psychedelic era with his earlier discovery in the late 1930s of the so-called magic mushrooms in Mexico. But he was an odd choice to become a 60s icon because his politics were wildly conservative. He didn't vote for the Republican Party. He professed not to believe in the American Revolution. He always voted for Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth. In fact, he was such an Anglophile that one of his colleagues once said that the only way for him to go native would be to go to England. And I walked into his office, having decided to go to the Amazon, having committed myself to go to the Amazon, and got as far as saying, "Sir, I'm from British." And that's all it took, that adjective. And I said, "I'm from British Columbia. I've saved up money in a logging camp, and I want to go to South America like you did and collect plants." Now, you might have expected this legendary figure to ask for my credentials or to ask who I was or what my family background was. He simply looked across a mound of specimens and said, "Well, son, when do you want to go?" And 2 weeks later, I was in the Amazon. And then the wonderful thing is David went to the Arctic. He's never come back. And I went to the Amazon, and I stayed for 15 months during that first sojourn. But I think this is really the texture of a life and the way that life-affirming and life-determining crossroads are met. And the key thing is to have the character, the desire, so that when those moments come, you respond in a way that is consistent with your own destiny. I probably was propelled also by the fact that for years in my life, I only had one word in my vocabulary for new experience, and that was yes.
Yeah. Let me say that I always begin the show asking that question about people's personal path, and the statement you're making, that it's accidents and it's just chance opportunities that you take advantage of, is echoed time and again. And what it tells me is these are men and women who've had significant lives and made significant contributions, and it's not because they had some goal in mind and single-mindedly pursued that. It's something very different.
Oh, I mean, in my case, it couldn't be more true what you said. I mean, I'd never took a biology course in my life, not even in high school, until third year of university when I came back from this long first trip to the Amazon. I mean, I became a writer simply because the backers of my work in Haiti suddenly had a heart attack and died. And so I had to get some money, and I walked off the street to a literary agent in London and said, "I've got a story about zombies. Are you interested?" And before I knew it, I had a book advance, and you know, that became The Serpent and the Rainbow. So I think all of life is made up of these kind of twists and turns, which is something which is quite wondrous about it.
Yes. Let me tell people that you're listening to Wade Davis, an explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, author of several books, including The Serpent and the Rainbow, and his most recent book, Light at the Edge of the World, subtitled A Journey Through the Realm of Vanishing Cultures, features photographs from his years of travels, as well as essays. And there's really a point to this book. It's not just random essays. And your point is?
Well, you know, in all the travels that I've done that I write about in this book, whether it's in Haiti or Tibet, the forests of Borneo, or in the ice fields of the high Arctic, I've always been excited by the dance of culture, the wonder of cultural diversity. And the great revelation of anthropology, of course, is the idea that the world in which we are, into which we are born, does not exist in some absolute sense, but is just one model of reality, the consequence of one particular set of adaptive choices that our lineage made, albeit successfully, many generations ago. But the great revelation of anthropology is the idea that there are other possibilities, other ways of being, and whether it's the Panan in the forests of Borneo, or the Inuit in the high Arctic, or the Voodoo Acolytes in Haiti, all of these cultures teach us that there are other possibilities. And to me, those cultures represent the collective legacy of humanity. And just as the biological web of life envelops the planet and is vital to the well-being of the planet, so too does this cultural web of life envelop the planet. And as part of our conservation initiative at the National Geographic, we have decided to call this web of life the ethnosphere. And you might define the ethnosphere as the sum total of all thoughts and dreams and myths and ideas and inspirations brought into being by the human imagination since the dawn of consciousness. The ethnosphere is humanity's legacy. It's the promise of the past. It's the legacy of the future, if you will. And the ethnosphere is being severely eroded, even as the biosphere is being eroded, but if anything, at a far greater rate. No biologist, for example, Terry, would dare suggest that half of all species are moribund or on the brink of extinction, because it simply is not true. And yet that, the most apocalyptic scenario in the realm of biological diversity, scarcely approaches what is known to be the most optimistic scenario in the realm of cultural diversity. And the great indicator of that is language loss. When you and I were born, there were 6,000 languages spoken on Earth. Now, a language is not just a body of vocabulary or a set of grammatical rules. A language is a flash of the human spirit. It's a vehicle through which the soul of a culture, each particular culture, comes into the material world. Every language is an entire old-growth forest of the mind, a watershed of thought, an ecosystem of spiritual possibilities. And of those 6,000 languages, as we sit here today, fully half are not being whispered into the ears of babies. They're not being taught to school children, which means that unless something changes, effectively, they're already dead. Every 2 weeks, somewhere on the planet, some elder passes away and carries with him or her into the grave a language. And so what this really means is that we're living through a period in which, quite literally, half of humanity's legacy is being lost in a single generation or two. This is the erosion of the ethnosphere. And what we're trying to do at the National Geographic is to draw people's attention to this by celebrating its wonder, even as we lament its passing, with the hope, of course, that in the end we will do something to stop this inexorable progression.
One question that struck me was, what draws you to a particular culture or a particular ritual or a set of plants and so on?
Well, I think it's simple curiosity, you know, curiosity about the other, you know, tempered by knowledge so that I'm driven in a certain kind of direction. I think what began this whole kind of journey was perhaps Baudelaire's, you know, what he said was the 20th century or the 19th century, malady, horror of home. I mean, I grew up in a kind of a very circumscribed suburb on the banks of the St. Lawrence River in Montreal. And I would look out at the river at night and sort of imagine the Cour de Bois and the Iroquois, you know, going up and down with the fur trade. And I, you know, my waking hours were given over to more prosaic pursuits, you know, baseball and football that marked the seasonal round of the English community of that village of Pointe Claire. And we lived in a world where the other was right there, four blocks down the street was a Francophone French-Canadian Quebecois community. And yet in that sort of unfortunate period in Canadian history, there was a chasm between the English-speaking Canadians and the French. And I think I was always intrigued as a child with that image of the other, you know, what is the taboo of the other, you know, that this bourgeois world is creating for me, you know. And I always wanted to know the other. And as I grew up and was fortunate to travel, I began to really understand this notion of different realities and different ways of being. I mean, I find it inherently interesting to know that Polynesian seafarers can sense the presence of a distant atoll over the horizon of the earth by looking at the reverberation of the waves on the surface of the sea. I find it interesting that the Mazatec farmers in Mexico have a vocabulary based on the wind. By mimicking the intonation of their language, they have something called whistle speech, which allows them to communicate across vast expanses of their mountainous homeland. I find it interesting that jaguar shaman of the Huarani and the other hunters of the Huarani in the forests of Ecuador can smell animal urine at 40 paces and tell you what species of life left it behind. And so all of these cultures, to me, you know, represent wondrous manifestations of the human spirit. And I think the other thing that I was always intrigued by was a dance of culture, the dance of meeting a new people. You know, you never know what to do. I mean, you know, you don't know. It's like, oh, it's almost like dancing with a woman for the first time or a partner for the first time. You don't know whether you're going to get the rhythm. You don't know what the outcome is going to be. You don't know how the evening's going to end. But that's the excitement of sort of first contact for an individual, not with the people who have no contact, but for you. And one of the things I learned very early as an anthropologist was that I could not imagine how I was to turn up in some village, perhaps of the Barasana, people of the Anaconda in Colombia, and announce to them that I was there for 6 months, they were going to house and feed me, and I was here to study your private lives. I mean, if someone turned up on our doorsteps with such a audacious plan of action, we'd call the police. So I very early on learned to seek the proper conduit to culture, the right way to break down the inherent barrier that exists by definition between you as an outsider and the people with whom you find yourself living as a guest. If, for example, I did want to be with the Barasana, a people of the rainforest of the Northwest Amazon, a people who cognitively do not distinguish the color blue from the color green because the canopy of the forest is equated to the canopy of the heavens, then obviously the means of access was a botanical realm. So I became a plant explorer and a botanist in good measure because it was the best way for me to understand, as an anthropologist, the life ways of those people. But if by contrast I wanted to study the mythology of Inuit people in the high Arctic, you know, a people for whom blood on ice is not a sign of death, but an affirmation of life, the obvious entry point was to become a hunter, because the myths are nothing more or less an expression of a covenant that exists between predator and a prey, and a way of the Inuit people rationalizing the terrible fact that to live they have to kill the thing they love most, the animals upon which they depend. So one of the parts of ethnographic research that I've always really enjoyed is how do you, you know, break down that barrier? And it's never bravado. It's more often empathy, you know, a willingness to sleep beside people on the stony ground, to eat what they eat, to live how they live, and to share something of yourself.
Okay. When you went to the Amazon, because that's the thing you happened to point at in that cafe, and Schultes happened to be at Harvard, and you saw that plants were the language, the entry point that would allow you access to that culture, you embarked on a study of many psychotropic plants. What have you learned about the place of psychotropic plants in those cultures other than our own and previous to our own? And what does that say about our sort of fractured attitude towards those same substances or those same experiences?
Well, I think the key thing is the reason we have such a confused attitude toward some of these curious psychoactive plants and is simply because we don't have the cultural context for understanding them. I mean, after all, these are plants that first came into our society a mere generation ago or two generations ago. And so that's not a deep enough time frame for us to really come to terms with them. It's not part of our tradition. I'm not saying that it shouldn't be or couldn't be, but it hasn't been. And I think what I discovered most about the use of these substances, and it's important to say that the reason indigenous people use psychoactive plants is to reach the spirit realm. And that desire to reach the spirit realm is a ubiquitous human trait. And the key point, of course, is that various cultures and various places in the world have various avenues to that place of the gods. And it's one of the most interesting things about ethnobotany is that of the 120 hallucinogenic plants that have been identified, close to 90% are from the Americas or from parts of Siberia. And this reflects the fact that the use of these plants is firmly rooted in culture. I remember the Haitians used to say to me, you know, you white people go to church and speak about God. The Indians eat their plants and speak to God. We dance in the temple and become God. And of course, this reflects the idea that in the African tradition, with few noted exceptions, psychoactive plants are not employed. But their route to the gods is spirit possession, the idea that you can invoke through ritual the spirits from beneath the great water who will momentarily displace the soul of the living so that for that brief shining moment, the individual actually becomes the god. So the use of plants to seek those places is firmly rooted in shamanism in general, but also in the Americas in particular. And of course, the shaman takes these plants not because they're drugs per se, because they're sacred medicines. And to understand that, you have to understand the nature of healing, the shamanic art of healing. You know, traditional societies, of course, don't distinguish a priest from the physician because the state of the soul is as important as the state of the body. And diseases can be treated on two very different levels. They can be treated symptomatically, much as we do, only in place of medicinal drugs. They use medicinal plants, many of which are pharmacologically active. But this level of treatment is considered somewhat mundane in many societies because it doesn't get to the root of the problem, which at least in those cultures is perceived to be in the realm of magic or in the realm of the spirit. And to get to that place, the shaman must invoke some technique of ecstasy to soar away on the wings of trance to get into those distant metaphysical realms where he or she can work their deeds of rescue. That accounts for the use of these curious psychotropic plants, which are arrows to the gods. But what I actually find most interesting about psychoactive plants is not the sheer dazzling effect of their chemistry, as much as what it can tell us about how the Indians live on the earth. You know, the most amazing thing about ayahuasca, for example, the well-known psychoactive preparation of the Amazon, is what it shows us about the botanical genius of the indigenous people. Ayahuasca is not a plant, it's a mixture. On the one hand, you have a shrub in the coffee family called Psychotria viridis, which has a series of potent tryptamines in it. Tryptamines are close to brain serotonin, 5-methoxydimethyltryptamine, dimethyltryptamine. These are powerfully psychoactive, but they cannot be taken orally. They cannot be taken through the mouth because they're denatured by an enzyme that exists naturally in the human stomach, monoamine oxidase. They can only be taken orally if taken in conjunction with some other drug that inhibits that enzyme in the human gut. Now it turns out that the second major ingredient of this shamanic preparation is a nondescript liana, botanically known as Banisteriopsis caapi, which has a series of beta-carbolines in it, harmine and harmaline and other constituents, which are MAO inhibitors, in other words, inhibitors of the enzyme of the precise sort necessary to potentiate the tryptamines in the shrub. Now, how you have to ask a question, in a flora of 80,000 species, how did these Indian people learn to combine these two morphologically dissimilar plants, these botanically unrelated plants, in this powerful and curious way, such that the, you know, you created a kind of a synergistic effect, the whole being greater than the sum of the parts. Now that really indicates the relationship to landscape in a sense, because if you ask the Indian, if you ask a modern scientist, they'll say, oh, it was trial and error. Well, run the statistical probabilities on that one to see how, you know, specious an argument it is. But if you ask the Indians, they'll say, well, don't you know anything? The plants tell us. That's how we learn. They're our teachers.
The show is Free Forum. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Wade Davis. He's an explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, author of several books, including The Serpent and the Rainbow, and his latest, Light at the Edge of the World, A Journey Through the Realm of Vanishing Cultures is in stores now, and it is a combination of wonderful, striking, beautiful photographs that he's taken over the years and essays. And he weaves the photographs and the essays together to make the case that we are losing cultures. We are losing parts of what he and the National Geographic are terming our ethnosphere at an alarming rate, and that that's a real loss to humanity on a whole and to you and I at the same time. Let me ask you again, I want you to, with your anthropologist viewpoint, what does the U.S., let's focus it just on this culture which we are immersed in, the U.S. war on drugs, the U.S. approach to those experiences found through plants, let's say at best, what does that say about our culture to you?
Well, I think every culture is capable of immense acts of folly. And Barbara Tuchman, the historian, once in a wonderful book defined folly as when a nation, though fully in possession of the facts, nevertheless persists in acting against its own self-interest. And the war of drugs will be seen 100 years from now as the greatest folly probably of the century, at least from the American perspective. I mean, just thinking in terms of 9/11, we were spending $20 billion a year on the war on drugs, and clearly we were fighting the wrong war. Why we have this kind of response to these substances probably is rooted in the fact that for whatever reason we define drugs not by based on pharmacology but by culturally rooted moral opinion, and so for the drugs that we habitually have used as a culture are dismissed with euphemisms. They're not drugs at all. They're a cup of coffee, a quick smoke, or a cocktail. And of course the drugs that have come from away from us are mysterious, threatening. And I think in to some extent, you know, the psychoactive substances are profoundly subversive. I mean, you know, they do have played an amazing role in culture change. I've always found it curious that in the revisionism of the last 30 years, when we think about the immense social changes that we've seen in our lifetime, attitudes, changes in civil rights, attitudes towards homosexuality, attitudes towards women, and most profoundly, attitudes towards the environment, the one clear ingredient in the recipe of social change, which has been expunged from the record by our own generation, is the fact that literally millions of us lay prostrate before the gates of awe under the influence of one of these undeniably powerful and suggestive and influential and fundamentally benign substances. So I think, you know, I can't have the answers for why we have this attitude towards these substances, but I do know that the projection of the war on drugs both overseas into Colombia and here at home has been a tragic mistake. But I'd like to go back for a moment to, you know, this idea of we were touching upon with ayahuasca in the Amazon about the relationship of native people to landscape, because there's a lot of misconceptions out there. You know, people tend to invoke either Rousseau and the image of the noble savage as if these people are genetically closer to the earth than we are, which is an idea both silly and racist in its simplicity. Or we tend to think they're better Thoreauians than we are. You know, they're more consciously aware. And the interesting thing about these cultures is that they are neither sentimental nor weakened by nostalgia, but they have nevertheless forged through time and ritual a traditional mystique of the earth that is based not on a self-conscious kind of Thoreauian idea of a relationship, but on a far subtler intuition. And that is the idea that the earth itself can only exist because it is breathed into being by human consciousness. Now, what do I really mean by that, and how does it play out?
How universal is that?
It's incredibly universal. For example, and what, when I explain what I mean by that, I think you'll see how universal it is, Terry. A Canadian kid, well, let's start in Peru, say, a Peruvian lad who grows up to believe that that mountain is an Apu spirit that will direct his or her destiny will be a profoundly different child than a Canadian kid raised to believe that a mountain's a pile of inert rock ready to be mined. Is that mountain a spirit? Is it a pile of inert rock? It doesn't matter. What matters is the belief system that mediates a relationship between the human being and the point on the planet. A kid from Canada raised to believe that a old-growth forest exists to be cut is going to be a different human being than a Kwagyul kid who knows that that forest is the abode of Hukuk and the Crooked Beak of Heaven and the cannibal spirits that dwell at the north end of the world, and at one point he's going to have to go into that forest in the Hamatsu initiation to meet those demonic forces to achieve illumination. And you see this in ritual played out all the time. Earlier in this year, in February, I participated in this fantastic event in Peru called the Mojimiento in a village called Chinchero, close to the imperial capital of Cusco. A stunningly beautiful mountainous landscape. It was the site of the summer palace of the second of the great Inca rulers, Topa Inca Yupanqui, and obviously they had their choice of real estate. And what happens here is that once each year, the fastest young boy from each hamlet dresses up head to toe as a woman and becomes transformed into a kind of transvestite figure called the Wailaka. And carrying the banners of the community, white flags, he leads all able-bodied men on an arduous marathon. It begins at 11,500 feet. You race down about 2,000 feet to the base, a full run, to the base of the sacred mountain of Anticilca. You storm up the mountain 3,000 feet to the summit ridge. You drop down the other side 3,000 or 4,000 feet, and again back up another 4,000 feet or so. And you do this for 25 kilometers around the perimeter of the community lands, a perimeter that is marked by mounds of earth called itos or mojones, where the group stops momentarily. The wailakas dance, prayers are uttered, coca is given to the earth, and the community moves on. And by the end of day, it is so physically exhausting that the participants, in a certain sense, coalesce as a group. It's almost as if they emerge from the mountains less as human beings than as spirit beings who have, through effort, through sacrifice, brought together a sense of the collective, a sense of the community, and reaffirmed their sense of belonging on the planet. And this is an incredibly powerful idea, to see how ritual plays out in these ways. We were talking about psychoactive plants. The same thing happens in the famous cult of the cactus of the four winds, which is based on the ingestion of Trichocereus pachinoa, this columnar cactus which we know has been used in medicinal ritual in the Andes and the coast of Peru for at least 4,000 years. Here, the patients arrive at a small Andean village of Huancabamba. There's a nocturnal ceremony which involves the drinking at midnight of a decoction of this cactus. During the ensuing intoxication, the curandero, or the maestro, the shaman, diagnoses a particular ailment. But the most interesting part of it occurs the next day, when the participants have to embark on a long pilgrimage high up into the mountains to a series of holy lakes around the periphery of which grow the medicinal herbs that are alone believed to be efficacious. But here's the metaphor. To heal the body, you must seek spiritual realignment, but you also have to move through sacred geography in order to embrace the earth, to get to those sacred lakes where you can have this moment of baptismal ceremony from which you can metamorphose into a new being, and only then will the medicinal herbs help you. Take another wonderful example that few people understand, which is Dreamtime, the Aboriginal Australians. You know, Dreamtime is really a misnomer because it was the closest that the Europeans could come to understanding the Aboriginal mind. The Aboriginal mind is based on, not the mind, but the belief system is based on the idea that there are actually two parallel universes at all times. There is the world of the phenomenological things that are around us. A rock's a rock, a tree's a tree. But at the same time, that world is constantly being dreamed into being, is being brought into being by the imagination. So when you walk the song lines, you are walking the trajectories, the itineraries that were laid out at the dawn of time by the ancestors when they sang the world into being. But as you walk them, you're also singing them into being. So a rock is a rock, but it is also still constantly in the process of being created as a rock. And this helps explain why in Australia, the cult of progress, the notion of objectively and carefully and deliberately changing the world around you, never came into being for over 60,000 years of recognizable human history. Because how can you have an idea of improving on something that doesn't exist yet?
That doesn't exist unless it's being sung into being.
Because it's constantly in a process of creation.
This is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2002 conversation with National Geographic Explorer in Residence, Wade Davis, about his experiences with psychotropic plants, the pluses and minuses of Western progress, and the threats to indigenous peoples as told in his book, The Light at the Edge of the World, A Journey Through the Realm of Vanishing Cultures. I'm Terry McNally. The show is Free Forum, and I'm speaking with Wade Davis. Wade is an explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, author of many books, and his latest book, Light at the Edge of the World, is a combination of photographs and essays which really look at the endangered cultures of the world, what they embody, what they have to teach us, and it also includes a call to action, that it is time not to view the loss of these cultures as just the inevitable wave of progress, but to see their value and begin to take a stand to reverse this, because as Wade has pointed out earlier in this interview, the threats to culture, the extermination of cultures, is far greater than the equally terrible threat that is faced by biodiversity. Let me ask a question which I thought I might hold towards later in the interview, but what really comes to me now, and I think this is a hard idea for me to get my head around, and I think for most people to get their head around. 10,000 years ago, some cultures opted for agriculture. And we, sitting here talking into this microphone, have been the beneficiaries, if you will, of the kind of progress that has happened since that decision was made. From there came so much that is now the dominant global culture. Now, that same day, 10,000 years ago, there was another tribe which didn't opt for agriculture and never has. And as you point out, there's 300 million indigenous folks still. Has progress occurred in their cultures in those 10,000 years? And if so, what does that feel like? What does that look like?
Well, it depends what you define by progress. You know, we tend to have this idea that these indigenous cultures are somehow frozen in time, as if some kind of zoological specimen. And that's how we come to the idea that somehow change is inherently a threat to them. And that's simply not the case. Every culture is constantly in a process of change, adapting to new possibilities for life. It's not change that threatens the integrity of the ethnosphere, for example. Similarly, it's not technology per se that threatens culture. I mean, a Sioux Indian did not stop being a Sioux Indian when he gave up the bow and arrow any more than an American farmer stopped being an American farmer when they gave up the horse and buggy. It's neither change nor technology per se that threatens the integrity of the ethnosphere. It's power, the crude face of domination. And, you know, in every single instance of these cultures that I speak about in the book, Light at the Edge of the World, these are societies that were not archaic, as if destined to fade away, as if by some natural law. In every case, these were living, dynamic, vibrant societies that are being driven out of existence by identifiable external forces that are more powerful and beyond their capacity to adapt to. For example, you know, in the forests of Borneo, the Panan are losing their homeland because of egregious deforestation. In the fertile soil of the Ogoni at the mouth of the Niger River in Africa, it's the effluent of the petroleum industry which is compromising the way of life of the people. In the homeland of the Yanomami in the upper Orinoco, it's diseases that have come in the wake of the gold miners who have rushed into their territory in recent years, and diseases that have so devastated the people. And this is both an optimistic and a pessimistic notion, because if people are the agents of cultural destruction, it means we can also be the facilitators of cultural survival. And I think it's important to stress that in all of this discussion, I am not dumping on any culture, including our own. I'm not interested flogging my own worldview. I think my own worldview is wonderful. I just don't have the hubris to believe that it's a paragon of human potential. You know, one of the things that And of course, all cultures are ethnocentric, fiercely loyal to their own interpretation of reality. So we're not unusual. I mean, to the contrary, many societies around the world that if you translate their name for themselves, it means the people, meaning that everybody else essentially is a barbarian. And indeed, the word barbarian derives from the Greek barbarous, which the Greeks used, which meant to babble, meaning anyone who didn't speak Greek was a babbler. You know, they might as well have been deaf and mute. They did not exist. But of course, in the new world of communication, we can no longer afford these kind of this isolation. And I think it's important to sort of put things in perspective. You know, you spoke about 10,000 years ago, the Neolithic Revolution that gave rise to agriculture, and that led in turn to hierarchy and sedentary life. It's interesting. I mean, the human species has been around for about 1 million years in an identifiable modern form. You know, 10,000 years ago, as you suggested, we started agriculture. 200 years ago, arguably 300 years ago, the industrial Western paradigm was born. Now that shallow history, however wondrous it's been, and how many terrific products it's given the humanity in general, that shallow history is not deep enough to suggest to me that this one way of being, this one modality, will have all the answers for all the challenges that we will face as a species over the next several hundred and indeed the next several thousand years. Why there is strength in diversity is because all of these diverse cultures around the world not only represent different possibilities of the human spirit, they represent different responses to challenges that confront human beings, and collectively they become part of our overall repertoire for dealing with the challenges that we will confront as a species. You know, it's useful to sort of, again, without flogging our worldview, just imagine that if you're an anthropologist who arrived here from Mars, for example, and you looked around the world, you'd see many wondrous things. And if you took the measure of success to be technological wizardry, our worldview would come up certainly close to the top, if not predominant. But if that same anthropologist would say, you know, well, I don't quite understand this. Let's take just one look at the United States for a second. Here's a culture that says that they revere marriage, and yet half their marriages end in divorce. They say that they revere their elders, but only 6% of them are prepared to have grandparents living in their homes with their children. They say that they love those children, but they embrace an obscene slogan like 24/7, implying as it does a total abdication of familial responsibilities and total dedication to workplace. Though it may explain why the average American father spends minutes a day with his child, if that. And then when you look at our propensity, which is just demonstrable, to compromise with our industrial processes, the very biological foundations of the planet, you'd have to conclude that yes, we're many wondrous things, but the paragon of humanity's potential, we clearly are not. We are one possibility, but there are other possibilities. You know, I love living with nomads. You know, there's this kind of myth that nomads wander and that farmers stay put. If you actually think about it in a deep sense, most nomads stay relatively where they are forever and live in a sustainable way from a habitat through which, a discrete habitat, through which they move constantly. Farmers, by contrast, represent an agricultural frontier that moves inexorably across the wild world, carving up that wild world, digesting that wild world, and constantly moving forward. It's the frontier that has swept across the great basin, that swept across the prairies, that have swept through the forest. This was an agricultural, not a nomadic frontier. And if you go to nomadic society, it's always fascinating, whether it's the Inuit in the high Arctic or whether it's the Penan, for example, in the forests of Borneo, you always notice certain clear, distinct traits. For example, if you're in a world where everything has to be carried on your back, there's clearly no incentive to accumulate material possessions, and especially in a world of no specialization where everybody knows how to make everything. So what then is the wealth of that society? What is the currency of that society? Well, the currency of that society is actually the strength of the relationships amongst people. And that's not a trivial idea. In these societies, it's essential, because if, say, there's a group of three of us, three men and five women, say, and a bunch of children. Now, if you and I, Terry, don't get along and we split, that means instantly that each of our groups that go with us will have a 50% less chance of securing food. So in nomadic societies, there is a huge social pressure to maintain the solidarity of the group. By the same token, in a nomadic society, sharing becomes an involuntary reflex because you never know who the next will be to get the food. So I've actually given a gift of a cigarette to Penan women in Borneo and watched as they've ripped open a single cigarette and separated out each individual strand of tobacco to distribute it equitably to the community, rendering the product useless, but honoring their obligation to share. And this again begins to give you a sense of how different choices create different realities. I've been with the Penan as we worked in a kind of an activist way with them and on their behalf in the 1980s. And I had Penan friends in my house in Vancouver or in San Francisco, and it was amazing to watch them walk down the street. I mean, they had never even been to a major city, but nothing in San Francisco impressed them as much as the homeless people. They just could not understand that a world that had so much could allow this to happen. We walk by that homeless person, and no matter how charitable we are, we think, well, tough luck, fellow, or bad break in our economy, or we might say lazy, too lazy. But they have a visceral reaction, and they think that they're raised to believe that a poor man shames us all. And this, again, is a very important point, which is that we forget that 200 or 300 years ago, during the Enlightenment, when we liberated the individual and created this Western tradition that clearly honors the individual at a higher, with a higher sort of value than the community itself. I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm not saying I wouldn't want to live in any other world. It's the world I know. But that was a tremendous shift in human history. It was a sociological equivalent of the splitting of the atom. Because for most of human history, the community has counted for more than the individual. Because without the solidarity of the community, the individual cannot survive. So this is, again, something that before we judge other cultures, if we want to really understand them, we have to understand what it is that drives them forward. What is the nature of their aspirations and their dreams?
Okay. You're listening to Free Forum on KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, and streaming globally at www.kpfk.org. I'm Terry McNally. I'm speaking with Wade Davis, author most recently of Light at the Edge of the World, A Journey Through the Realm of Vanishing Cultures. And as you can tell, that's much of what we're speaking about. Wade is also an explorer in residence at National Geographic, who is the publisher of this book. I want to press the question I asked before, just because I would hate to lose the opportunity to ask it. And then I have other questions about the impact of these cultures. But I have spent some time with the Ashuar in the rainforest, and in communicating, and in my brief time in speaking with them, It occurred to me that, in fact, they were supple-minded, you know. I mean, you know, just to take away any... This is a group of people that I think had their first contact with Western, our culture, about 26, 27 years ago, in the 70s. So they were...
No, the Ashuar were contacted probably in the 20s, 30s.
Okay, you know. In any case.
Recently.
Yeah, recently. They were basically prehistoric in the last century. And yet, as I see, facile, supple minds, able to adapt and so on. So that question that I asked before, I'm going to ask one more time just because I'm so curious. If a culture has had the same 10,000 years in which Western U.S., this global, multinational, corporate culture, whatever it is, has created all these products and so on, what were they just refining their plant knowledge, refining their dream knowledge? And if you don't have a sense of this, that's fine and we'll move on. But if you have some sense, you've spent so much more time with folks like that.
Back to this notion of, you know, of progress. You know, we have, for all kinds of different reasons, a kind of an entire economy that is based on growth, on innovation, on change, on progress, as it's called. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but we have to understand that because these societies do not embrace that, doesn't mean that they're backward. You know, one of the great misconceptions, even of 19th century anthropologists, was that there was some kind of social evolutionary ladder to success that invariably put Victorian England at the apex, as if it was a self-fulfilling prophecy, because what was considered to be advanced were the accoutrements and the traits of the society that was defining the paradigm. And what anthropologists realize, of course, is that this is nonsense, and that by biological definition, every human population has the same mental acuity. Now, whether that raw intelligence is put into an intellectual process that spits out all these marvels of engineering, or whether it's put into the complex threads of memory involved in a series of mythological tales, really is a matter of cultural choice and historical accident. Again, this is not to say we're wrong, but it is not to say, they're primitive. It's a nonsensical idea. I mean, for example, when the British first went to the Arctic and met the Inuit, they took them to be savages because of their material technology. The Inuit, for their part, took the British to be gods. Both were wrong, but one did more to honor the human race. And what the British could not understand was that there is no better measure of raw intelligence than the capacity to survive in an environment where your entire technology, your entire material culture, was based on what you could carve from rock, stone, slate, bone, and the odd piece of wood that floated up like flotsam from the sea. So, when the British mimicked the ways of the Inuit, they achieved great feats of exploration, and when they failed to do so, they suffered terrible deaths. And for example, when Lord Franklin's men were found at Starvation Cove, dead in their leather traces, they were literally hauling behind them because they didn't think that it was proper sport for dogs to be used in sleds, but they had no problem putting their young naval lads in leather harnesses, which may tell you something about the British. But they were hauling behind them an oak sled that weighed 900 pounds, made of oak and iron, in Manchester. On that was a dory from their ship, which weighed 500 pounds, again made in Manchester or some seaport in England. And inside that dory were all the accoutrements of a naval officer's dinner service, including a copy of the novel The Vicar of Wakefield. And somehow they expected to drag this across the Arctic into the forests of northern Canada, hoping that they might bump into a Hudson Bay post and achieve salvation. Of course, they suffered a terrible death, but the Inuit moved lightly upon the land. They didn't fear the cold. They took advantage of it. The runners of their sled were made of fish, three Arctic char laid in a row and wrapped in the hide of a caribou skin, of a caribou that was greased with the stomach content. You want to talk about progress and intelligence, and you have to also consider adaptability and survival and the amazing feats of the Inuit. I mean, I recorded the most amazing tale, which I later verified in the ethnographic literature, when I was narwhal hunting in the tip of Baffin Island. During the 1950s, in an attempt to establish Canadian sovereignty to an archipelago that could easily have gone back to the Norwegians or the Danes or even to the Americans or even the British for that matter, the Canadians forced the Inuit into settlements. And this one man I met at a place called Arctic Bay told the story of his grandfather, who had categorically refused to go into the settlements. The family, fearful for his life, took away all of his implements, all of his weapons, all of his tools, thinking that that would oblige him to settle down. It didn't. In the middle of an Arctic night, with a blizzard blowing, he stepped outside of the igloo and pulled down his trousers and defecated into his hand. As the human waste froze, he shaped it into the form of a blade. As the knife made out of feces solidified, he sprayed saliva along its edge to give it a sharp edge, and as the shit knife took final form, he used it to kill a dog. He skinned the dog with it, took the skin of the dog and made a harness, took the rib cage and improvised a sled, harnessed up an adjacent dog, and shit knife in belt disappeared over the ice floes. Now you talk about getting by with nothing, but talk about raw intelligence brought into being by adaptation. So the fact that the Inuit never had a cult of progress because they simply lived lightly upon the land and lived from the land and had no sense of wanting to improve upon the land, the fact that it just lived is no sign of anything except perhaps a better way of being. I mean, this is the whole point. If you took the measure of success to be technological wizardry, that's one thing. But if the measure of success was stewardship, the capacity to live in a truly sustainable way, our Western paradigm would clearly fail.
Question I want to ask is, if to 90 or 95% of the people, certainly people within the sound of our voices and so on, may never visit these indigenous people, may never have actual contact with them. What is the impact, since they seem so marginalized, what is the impact that we lose in real terms if they disappear?
I think the most important way to answer that is consider the events of 9/11. You know, 9/11 was a stunning moment in human history, and it brought these two worlds together. Now, we shouldn't, again, flagellate or flog the United States, but this is a country born in isolation, quite self-consciously so. And we forget what lies beyond our borders. You know, it's difficult for a country where the 30 million African Americans have more wealth than the 30 million Canadians, or where our defense budget is a trivial percentage of our GDP, is nevertheless larger than the entire economy of Australia. It's hard for us, anesthetized by our wealth, blinded by our wealth, to imagine a world where 1.3 billion people get by on less than a dollar a day. And wired for the internet, it's hard for us to understand a world in which the vast majority of the world's population has never had a phone call, let alone sent an email. And the face of the West that is projected, it's not just the face of America, it's a face of modernity. And modernity in much of the world has been operating under the illusion that if societies throughout the world, not just small indigenous societies, all societies follow the dictates of this one way of being, this one paradigm, they'll all be economically elevated to our level. Well, that ain't going to happen. And it were to happen, it would take the resources of probably four planet Earths. What in fact happens time and time again in small cultures and large is individuals are torn from their past, propelled into an uncertain future, and at the very best they secure a place in the bottom rung of an economic ladder that goes nowhere, and they drift off to these endless cities that are exploding like cancers across the face of the earth, whether it's Lima, Peru, that's gone from a population of 400,000 in 1940 to 9 million today, or Cairo, Islamabad, or you name it. And out of these endless seas of misery emerge forces that respond to that humiliation and sometimes respond in violent and cancerous and insane ways. And that, of course, is what the Al-Qaeda represented. And so 9/11, even as we attempt to expunge from the human record these dreadful individuals and their heinous crimes, it behooves us to understand where this sense of resentment comes from. And the answer, of course, is that we no longer can indulge our isolation. We have to recognize the absolute urgency of a kind of global declaration of interdependence where we find a way to move not toward a monochromatic world of monotony, but truly to a polychromatic world of diversity and multiculturalism and pluralism, whereby the absorption of all the genius of the human species, all the technological innovation, can benefit all human societies, but it shouldn't necessarily imply the eradication of the ethnicity of the people.
Okay, we're going to have to pull it to a close. Thank you, Wade Davis. Thank you for the work you've been doing, the beautiful writing and photography that the photography in this book and the writing in all of your books. Thank you to Ian Johnston, my engineer, and to you, listeners. To learn more about the show, guests, podcasts, articles, and so on, you can visit me at terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Or a world that just might work, all one word, a world that just might work.com. They're the same website. You can listen to podcasts there at iTunes. You can sign up there at iTunes to have the podcast delivered to you weekly. You can also sign up there or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, to get my weekly email telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and three or four articles of background. You can also check out Free Forum with Terrence McNally on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. You've been listening to Free Forum. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Welcome to Code WAC, your podcast on America's broken healthcare system and how Medicare for All could help. I'm your host, Brenda Gazar. How did Hugo Morales, co-founder and executive director of Radio Bilingüe, become such an impassioned champion for farm workers' rights in California's Central Valley and beyond? What life experiences shaped him into the influencer that he is today? We recently had the honor of asking him ourselves. So what was life like for you as a boy in the U.S.?
We settled in a farm labor camp with my father. And so we grew up with no health insurance, no minimum wage, no sanitation regulations or enforcement, no inspection of the sanitary facilities there. At the same time, during the summer was prune season. There was a 100-acre prune farm. That's when the migrants would come and help pick the crops. And got to see, you know, hundreds of cars of migrants come through and, you know, with no job, literally with cars full of children. And the children, of course, would work. Got to see how parents are deprived of having a decent salary, so people for keeping health insurance or properly take care of their children or properly provide nutritious food, and lack of information about nutrition and their rights and so on. So I ended up actually at a tuberculosis hospital from that experience. Tuberculosis follows poverty and all that. I mean, so I ended up locked up for a year in isolation when I was 12 years old. So I have a history in terms of access to healthcare. And of course, I had a contagious disease. So I was pulled out of school when I was a seventh grader out of Healdsburg Junior High and put in isolation.
Get the full Code WAC story on progressivevoices.com and on the PV app. Catch all our episodes by subscribing to Code WAC wherever you find your podcasts. This podcast is powered by Heal California, a nonprofit that uplifts the voices of those fighting for healthcare reform around the country. Until next time, stay healthy.